Pathprojects.com. You know, if you are a 5 on a beauty scale, if you're on a 5 and you want to go to a 7, it's all about what you put on your body. Path Projects.
And what I choose is the Pyrenees, that hooded, wonderful, everyday wear stuff. I find myself putting Path on more for everyday wear than I do on the trail. And you know I love it on the trail.
I don't think I've seen you in the last probably 3 or 4 weeks without your Pyrenees hoodie.
I even shower in it. I love this
That's
thing.
How you wash it?
And we have Scott Bailey on the line with us, with the founder of Path Projects. Scott, how do you keep doing this, making people look better?
It's a tough job, but it's something that we love to do. I mean, we set out to make great running product first and foremost, and we want to make sure that you can wear it everywhere and always want to wear it everywhere. So that's really our goal.
Hey, so often you think about shorts and baseliners when you think Path Projects, but they're much, much more than that. There are shirts and their Pyrenees hooded jacket and a
hat.
And a hat. Thank you.
The buff.
I was pointing at my head. The people should have saw that.
You know, if you feel good, you look good. And I would take that to the trail, that if you feel good on the trail and things are where they're supposed to be, they're not distracting, you're going to enjoy your time on the trail a little bit better. And that's what I've found from Path. That's where I think I enjoy running better, because I don't have to worry about my stuff.
You know, the magic of Path is in the fabric. Tell us a little bit about how careful you are selecting the fabric, Scott.
Yeah, what we try and do is use fabrics that have natural properties rather than a lot of chemicals or synthetics. So we use a lot of the products that we use in our tops are made from tinsel, which comes from eucalyptus trees, which is naturally antimicrobial and naturally quick dry. They're just fabrics you don't see from other people because the cost is really high on these fabrics, and our consumer direct model lets us create things at a great product at a great price.
And direct to us, so we get that great product for a great price.
It's like we own our own running store. It's like
we're our own retailer.
That's right.
Hey, Scott, thanks for inventing and coming up with these great products. They are so comfortable, and we just love them.
Exoskin, your second skin, the power of copper.
Let's talk about copper. Copper naturally has antimicrobial properties, and the mad scientists at Exoskin have figured this out. They've taken very fine copper threads and they've woven it into their fabrics so that those fabrics don't create or feed on bacteria. It kills that stuff. It kills the fungus that makes your socks all grody and nasty.
Well, not only your socks, but anything else that they put this copper thread through works. And we need to keep things fresh, especially around the areas that need to stay fresh.
Figure out the power of copper for your own by going to our partners page and click on the banner. Right now they have a lot of cool discounts that you can try out that will help motivate you to get this stuff.
25% off with the code EXOHOLIDAY and multiple savings as you buy additional gear.
Exoskin.com.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
You're trying to move. That's all you got. That's all you can do right now. You got it, Dylan. You got it, man. You can rally.
Mile 76, how you feeling?
You know, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm tired.
What do you think? What do you think of the course today? What do you expected?
It's tough.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Mr. Jones Wilkins is still hunched over.
There, where were we?
We were about to run.
Yes, I think we better do that.
All right. That's Ultra.
All right. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name's Scott Ward.
And I'm Don Freeman. And today we have a guest. You know, I received a book called Kixology, Scott, and there has been very few books that I've been excited to open up, and it was this one.
Because you're a judo fan?
No, because it talks about shoes. And we have Brian Metzler here with us today, and he is a tester of shoes, over 1,500 sets of shoes he's tested. He's run 75,000 miles during his lifetime. He's run short races from 5Ks up to 100 miles and knows a little something about shoes. So welcome, Brian.
Hey, thanks, guys. I'm happy to be here.
And a trail community member. As I recall, you're one of the founding members of Trail Running Magazine. Is that right?
I'm actually the founding editor-in-chief of Trail Runner Magazine, yeah, back in 1999, and had a couple cohorts with me at the time. But yeah, we launched that in 99, and then 20 years later, it's still doing well.
And you live in the running mecca of Boulder, Colorado, with a bunch of snow, I hear.
Well, a bunch of snow. They call it the People's Republic of Boulder. But yeah, there's a bunch of snow right now and a bunch of ultra runners here. But yeah, it's not a bad place to be.
Hey, you know, one of the things that caught me right off, I'm going to dig right into this book. Is that all right, Brian?
Yeah, for sure.
One of the things that caught me and I thought was funny, because I've done the same thing. People walk into a shoe store, they'll pick up a shoe, they'll kind of toss it up and down, they'll kind of twist it and torque it, they'll push their thumb into the heel, all for assessing whether this shoe is the right shoe for them.
Hold it up to the light.
They'll smell the inside of it and see if it's the right shoe. What are we doing? And what are they doing? And should we be doing that?
It's like the produce section at the grocery store. I actually worked in a produce department when I was in high school, when I was running track, ironically. But yeah, people would come and pick up the fruit and the melons and squeeze them and smell them. But yeah, at a running store, it's all about fit, right? I mean, like, we can all say this shoe is great, or that shoe is great, or this shoe wins an award, or this color is cool, or it's a new model. That doesn't matter. What matters is how it fits your foot. And that's, I mean, like, for any runner, I mean, we could all name our 10 favorite shoes of all time or right now. And they fit me different than they fit you. And they don't, you know, you can't do that. I mean, like, so it's fun to touch and smell and twist and poke, but really you got to try them on.
Hey, and just a public service announcement. This was not planned, but you folks that are putting your thumb and fingers into my avocados in the produce department, please don't do that because you don't need to do that to check out whether they're ready or not. And then when they're finally ready, I have all of your fingerprints in the middle of that avocado. Go ahead, Scott. You have something pertinent that relates to shoes and running.
I was just going to say, you know, this is a topic that inevitably comes up on most of the runs that you do, especially long runs. I think when I start a run, just this last run that we did together on last Saturday, I looked down and kind of determined who I was running with by what shoes they were wearing. I don't know if you remember that. We met up with Tim on the trail, and I said, hey, which one of us doesn't belong? Because three of us were wearing one brand, and you were wearing the other brand.
Yeah, you guys clearly didn't belong. We do get married to a set of shoes. What's the fascination with shoes, Brian? How come we can never tire about talking about thinking about shoes?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Of all the sports and all the activities humans do, shoes, I mean, certainly footwear you walk around in, but specifically running shoes are so personal because of the joy that they bring you, hopefully, and the excitement and, you know, that feeling of, wow, I feel good, right? I mean, like, we almost never go for a run and come back feeling worse, right? We always feel better, even on bad runs, right? But you have this really just unlimited enthusiasm and excitement for running, and the shoes take you there. You know, it's like, it is a product, right? And it is a commodity, but it's something more than that. It's got a special quality to it that kind of transcends just being this physical thing. I mean, if you think about like your best marathon or your best trail run or whatever it was, I mean, you know that, wow, that was part of it, right? I mean, much, much more than a t-shirt or a hat, or it's just, I don't know, it's, you know, different than like probably a basketball at a basketball game, because it's the basketball is universal to the whole game and every player. I mean, like it's different. It's very personal. It's your feet. And I think that there's probably more to the personality or the smarts of your foot brain connection than any of us know. I think we can sense it as runners, but I really think that there's a lot going on, almost like your fingertips sense a lot of things. I think your feet sense a lot of things too, and how you interact with the earth. So I think that's probably the unknown part of it, but I believe that very much.
There's a lot of emotion that come into to running. You know, as you were just talking, I was thinking, Don and I were speaking earlier today. We know what shoes we ran our first Western states in.
Sure, whatever race or whatever achievement, you know, there's a set of shoes. And I have a hard time breaking free of those shoes. I have shoes saved that I'll never wear again, but I just can't bring myself to throwing them away.
How many pair of shoes do you have in your garage there, Brian?
1,500.
Not 1,500, but I probably have at least 200. I think in my current rotation, it might be 20, depending on what I consider current. But no, I agree with that. I mean, like, why would you throw something away that is so memorable, right? I mean, like, it's. I have those shoes, too, and I look at them, and I'm like thinking, wow, I love this. I might never wear it again, but I love it. There's a connection to it. So, yeah, I don't know. It's like they become these mementos, right, of something, of a race finish or just a period of time in your life. And, yeah, why would you throw them away? But, I mean, again, that speaks to the special kind of inherent quality a shoe has once you start running in it.
And I love that at the beginning of the book, you set it up how when you were in cross country, how you were striving to get that new pair. I think they were blue ASIC racing flats. And you told your mom, I need a pair of those. And you ran around town trying to find these pair of blue ASICs because that's what the guy who won the marathon in the Olympics was wearing. And yeah. And you thought that if he's wearing them, I should be wearing them.
It's an amazing thing. I think, you know, footwear is, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of kind of what's the pro wearing. I mean, there's a lot of that going on, especially now with all these carbon fiber shoes and also the unknown shoes that a lot of great runners are wearing. But I think there's a lot of, like, you see that and you think, wow, I want to perform that way. I want to run that way. I want to compete that way. And I think that, you know, that is something that probably carries over to other things that people have this almost like a lust for. Right. But for me as a kid, I just wanted to be able to run better, to look better running maybe, and to feel like I belonged. And I think that the running shoes that I wanted and craved for, I sense were a big part of that whole equation for me.
Did you ever buy, or how many pairs of shoes did you buy because they looked fast on the shelf?
Yeah, I'm a sucker for that still. Maybe because I'm not fast anymore, but I think that, you know, the appearance of running shoes is a unique thing. You know, it's like we've all seen the designs and the uppers and the materials change, and that's a big part of you know, what the draw is. And I've bought a bunch of shoes that I either thought would be fast or I wound up being fast in. But at the same time, there's also been a bunch of shoes that maybe look great and didn't run that well. So you can't get too caught up in that, but, it certainly is, you know, this part of this dynamic equation of what is it? What is a shoe? Why are we attracted to that? Or why do we think it works well? You know, and ultimately, again, it better come down to fit first. Cause there's a lot of shoes I've run in that I wouldn't want to wear, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny you said that. It does come down to fit. I bought offline a shoe that I thought was so good looking. It was the Montrail shoe. This may have been 12 plus years ago. And it had the Montrail logo written on the side and kind of, you know, I forget how they put it on there. But it was painted on. It looked so good. But the size was not my size. It was one size too small. But I said, forgo that. I don't care. Those look so great. And I never enjoyed the shoe, not even a single mile, except on my shelf they looked great. But on my feet, they felt terrible. But I don't regret the purchase because they look fast.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I bought a pair. It wasn't necessarily a true running shoe, but before trail runners really became trail runners, Nike made a shoe called the Moab in about 1994, 95. And it had this like cool, like faux leather and green and purple and everything else. And I really wanted them. And the place in town I went, they only had 10s. I'm a 10 and a half. And like, I tried them on. I'm like, it's too small. I'm like, but I bought them anyway because I wanted them. I thought they were cool. And I ran a bunch of trails in them and everything else. I would like sometimes not wear socks to make them fit better. And it's, you know, we're suckers sometimes. And I'm sucker number one, maybe, but it's that draw of the shoe and the aesthetic has a lot to do with it for sure.
Hey, let's go back to the kids piece just for a second. And this isn't written in the How to Be a Kid rule book. They seem to all know it because I remember, and I've watched every kid that I've seen with a new pair of shoes, they're convinced that they can run faster. They can cut corners quicker. They can jump higher just because of a shoe. And that's just innate. That's just inside of us. That isn't written on the shoebox or, you know, the shoe person doesn't say you'll be able to run faster. We just know it intuitively. Yeah, okay. Both eyes work. Just a great shoe to make us perform better. How do we, where does that come from? Is that in our DNA?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, whether we were truly born to run or not, I mean, I don't know. And if you reference Born to Run, both the book and Notion, that's more of a long distance kind of sustenance hunting kind of reference. But to your point, I mean, I think we all love to sprint as kids. We all love to feel that wind in our face and, you know, running across the schoolyard, or whether you're chasing someone or getting chased or in a game of any sport, baseball, kickball, whatever it is. But I had that feeling too. And I think I wrote about that, you know, when I was a real young kid, my brother had these fast sneakers, you know, and he was 2 years older than me, so always faster. And you know, I finally got my pair of sneakers and I was like over the moon, right? All I wanted to do is put them on, just buzz around anywhere, right? Run anywhere. I'll just, you know, open the car door, open the front door, and psh, I'm running, you know, and I don't know what it is, but I think that, yeah, and sadly, I think that as adults, sometimes we lose that, you know, and if more people would appreciate that sense of movement and that sense of freedom, or carry it with them out of childhood, out of grade school, out of high school, that could maybe lead to other things. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe a lot of people are doing that with running and marathons and half marathons and ultras. I don't know. I mean, like, I certainly still in me. So
yeah, I buy shoes in the hopes that it's going to turn me into that fast runner that I always wanted to be. But now this may date me, but it will certainly date you if you're out there listening and can remember this shoe. Do you remember the PF Flyer?
Yeah.
Oh man, that shoe would make you go pretty
PF
fast.
Flyer.
The PF. Well, don't act like you're younger than that, Scott.
No, I've heard of it, but I'm trying to picture.
Weren't
it
they
mind.
Keds? Weren't they a Keds shoe that was like?
I believe so. Yeah.
And really, the technology was no more than a Converse All Star, just a flat bottom piece of rubber and cloth on the top. But it did have two racing stripes right on the edge. Yeah, red and blue went along that. Yeah, it made you fast.
Hey, man, they went a long way with canvas and rubber back in the day, and you know, there was no such thing as a carbon fiber plate that. But those PF Flyers and other similar shoes in that area, you felt like you could run that fast.
So let's talk about the evolution of shoes. Where did they start? How come all of a sudden there's all this attention to redesigning and creating a better shoe? Let's talk about from the moccasin to this Carbon X shoe that's out there these days.
Yeah, I mean, best I can tell, I mean, obviously, humans have been running races for centuries, a long time. If you go back to the ancient Olympics, if you go to a lot of civilizations that had running in their culture, certainly footwear was part of it. Certainly running barefoot was part of the first Olympics. But if you look at kind of the evolution of running and competition, certainly as humans evolved and footwear became a thing, I think eventually you saw more specialized footwear, probably in somewhere, you know, people debate in the late 1700s or the early 1800s in Europe, you know, people probably had a better idea of kind of what shoe would be a faster shoe for, you know, race and probably other sports as well. But I think the first piece, which I alluded to, was when Foster's and Sons in London was making track spikes. They put nails in shoes to make better traction for the cinder tracks of the day. And I think that might be the first, you know, kind of semi-mass produced athletic shoe. And then we went from there. I think Adi Dassler, you know, started his footwear company, I believe, right after World War One, or maybe in that era, and certainly made a lot of shoes for athletes in the 1920s for Olympics and such. And it went from there. I think that's really the launching point of modern Olympics, or modern footwear rather. And certainly as these sports gained more fame, more notoriety, as tracks turned from cinder to all weather. Certainly that changed things as materials, as modern manufacturing evolved, so did footwear as well. And so when you had, you know, the first, you know, a lot of, you know, original training shoes were leather and then eventually rubber and then eventually canvas and got lighter. And it just kind of went from there.
And then it exploded. You know, the first running boom was in the 70s, and all of a sudden these other shoe manufacturers start getting engineers and so-called experts that started adding cushion and incline and all this stuff, and we kind of went away from the basics. Why did we go there? Why did that make sense?
That's a really good question. I think that, you know, we can look to some of the pioneers of running and coaching. I mean, Arthur Lydiard and Bill Bowerman certainly had a big role in training athletes in modern ways, but they also had a good idea of how to make footwear be better for running. And so why do we evolve from the basic shoes? I mean, there was, you know, the New Balance Trackster was a really kind of first modern shoe that had that rippled rubber outsole. It's a picture in the book, and that was one of the first shoes really dedicated to running. But through the 60s and 70s, yeah, we evolved. And what quickly happened, and you alluded to it, is that brands got competitive, right? As all of a sudden this mushrooming sport or recreation of running, of marathoning took off in the 1970s, I think you saw a lot of brands getting into it, right? And all of a sudden selling shoes and making money and everything else. It kind of went from there. And then marketing became a big part of it. You know, our foam is better than theirs. Ours feels better than on your feet. And if you look at the old ads that were running at the time in Runner's World and Runner Magazine, there was a lot of playful competition kind of at the time, you know, well before, you know, the great Nike ads of the 1980s and the great Adidas ads of the 1990s. I mean, like marketing became a big thing back then. And that was, you know, fueled by true innovation and competition and improving a shoe for performance sake, but also because you had this huge, at the time, huge explosion of runners, it was really fueling like this desire of what this look was, you know, how shoes look became important in the 1970s for the first time. And so that obviously, you know, went into the 80s, 90s, and still a part of it now. I mean, like how a shoe looked and kind of, it said you were a runner, but it said more than that too. So yeah, competition and marketing were big, big parts of it.
Yeah, you said to identify yourself as a runner, but so many people purchase these shoes that never run, that aren't runners, just so they can have that look, so they appear to be runners, or they just like the fashion statement of a running shoe
or the feel.
You know that, yeah, they're comfortable.
All those things are true. And I, you know, I've said for years, and one of my first, you know, kind of observations of running shoes as a social statement or as a piece of our culture was going through airports. At some point, you realize that everyone's wearing running shoes, or most people are, at least in American airports. Not so much in Europe, and definitely not in Asia. But and here, at some point, probably I would say in the early to mid 90s, people stopped wearing maybe more sophisticated brown shoes to travel in, and now you go and like most people are wearing running shoes, and you know that most people, you know, shoes aren't runners, and that's fine, and it's not to be derogatory at all, but to your point, people like the feel of running shoes. They're comfortable, right? And yeah, they look good, they're sporty, they have an athletic vibe, which hopefully says a lot about the person wearing them. But it's done a couple of things. Yeah, not everyone who wears running shoes is a runner, but it shows how big the industry got by selling shoes to people who weren't runners. And it also launched this whole other kind of category that we talk about now, athleisure. And that's kind of a sporty, flexible, comfortable shoe that isn't necessarily for running, but it's kind of exploded in all these different dimensions. But it really shows how much running shoes have gotten bigger than running itself. Running itself is still, we know it's this big, even though huge, but running shoes, it's a massive, massive industry, massive category.
And I think wasn't a part of Steve Jobs' uniform. He had the jeans, the black sweater, and New Balance shoes. Is that right?
I think he wore New Balance. Yeah, I mean, like, and there's a lot of people that have done that. I mean, like, it became this cool, trendy thing, and like, and a lot of shoes took off that way. I mean, like, I would say the New Balance 801 was the best worst trail runner shoe of all time. I mean, like, if you remember that shoe in the 1990s, it was kind of a whitish off-white shoe with a blue swoosh with a yellow highlight, and there was a men's and women's version. And you know, before people were talking about trail running, it was a trail running shoe, but it was a shoe that somebody, you know, wore to the mall, or, you know, mom picking up the kids in the minivan. It was a funny phenomenon, but like, that was for a while the top selling shoe in the 90s, you know, and like those kind of things, certainly are representative of all those things that people wanted to look athletic and sporty and have this badge of honor. Like, yeah, I'm a runner. And, you know, it's, I can't think of another version of something we do or wear. I know for, well, in some cases, like basketball shoes are that thing for some people, but running shoes, it's a really pervasive thing in our culture.
When was the first real trail running shoe? When did it come out? I mean, whether that was specifically designed for trail running or whether it was marketed for trail running, do you remember?
That's a good question. I would say, what was Gordy wearing when his horse broke down? I mean, that would be my first thing. But you know, a lot of trail runners, you know, back in the day would wear hiking boots or light hikers or road running shoes. And you know, I think people credit whether true or not, Adidas Response Trail somewhere in the early 1990s, I think, as a true maybe first trail running shoe. I know a lot of other shoes that evolved. Even road running shoes had better traction for them. And I think that runners were resourceful and said, okay, this is, you know, there were some ASIC shoes that had better outsoles. You know, they weren't necessarily trail running shoes before that. But I think, you know, the Response Trail was the first probably shoe that really took off as a marketed trail shoe. And it was essentially a soft foamy road running shoe with a more aggressive lug bottom. So, but that was probably the first, I think, that really kind of had a wider scale of sale as a trail running shoe. I mean, and then you look at, like, you know, Montrail's rise. If you look at what Scott McCoubrey did in 1996, 97, 98 to crisscross the country with a van of Montrail shoes that no one knew about. One sport initially, then Montrail, and had people trying on Montrail the test. I mean, that's probably the first big trail running shoe that everyone's like, oh, I got to have that. Cause everyone that ran back then had at least one pair of Vitesse.
You know what I think's funny is you're talking about wearing a light hiking shoe as a trail running shoe. And now you look at the thru hikers and they're not wearing hiking boots. They're wearing trail running shoes, which I think is kind of an interesting dichotomy there.
Absolutely. You know, the crew at Ultra has told me several times they've had a lot of thru hikers, have them ship new shoes to trailheads or whatever. And I think that's very true. I think that we all understand that, like, trail running shoes are much better, much more dynamic, much more cushioned, much more flexible, much more, you know, have much better long wearing comfort for trails. I mean, if we know if trail runners wear them and ultra runners wear them, we know that hikers would certainly wear them. I think that, you know, the last time I had a stiff pair of hiking boots on, God, was 20 years ago. And I, you know, when I first moved to Colorado, I was doing a lot of 14ers, and maybe my first couple, I used big hiking boots, and then now I just wear trail running shoes, right? Because why? They're more agile, they're more nimble. I feel more secure in trail running shoes than I ever would a big boot. So yeah, it's funny how trail running shoes have evolved and have more uses than just running trails.
Well, I've become quite a hiker on many of my long trail runs. So I guess it works both ways. Go ahead, Scott.
You know, and you discuss it very, very well in the book. We have ebbed and flowed in the cycle of trail running shoes, where we went to these big cushiony things, then we went to these very minimal things, whether it's the Vibram Five Fingers or even wearing sandals or really thin-soled shoes. Where are we now? The reason why I ask that is I go out and I run with people and I see people in, you know, the big cushioned Hokas. And then I see people in very minimal shoes, and it's hard for me to identify. Where do you think we are, Brian?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, like, I still see people on the trails here in Colorado, especially the 14ers in the summertime, and people, or even on the incline. I was on the incline in Manitou 2 weeks ago, that really steep, you know, stair step trail. And some of the footwear there, I'm like, what are you wearing those for? And it's like, you know, if someone wearing Nike Freeze on a 14er, I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, I mean, like, lightning's a problem here, but those shoes are a problem, you know? So where are we now? I think that everything under the sun is available now. I mean, like, people keep asking me, are we going to see a carbon fiber plated trail running shoe? And I'm like, yeah, probably. You know, it comes down to, though, what I said before, it's all about how it fits you, how you understand how your foot and the shoe interact with the ground. I think that's the most important thing. I think that knowledge, though, isn't out there. If you go to your best running shops and trail running shops, certainly you can get that service and that fit and understand that. But I think that most people don't take that into consideration, maybe. I think that because a lot of people buy either online or just go to a sporting goods store, there's still a lot of disconnect. I think certainly, again, at the sharper end of the spear, certainly the more experienced trail runners understand that. But it comes down to kind of how it fits your foot. And so, get back to your question, where are we now? It's like, we're kind of wherever you want to be. I mean, if you prefer a lighter weight, more minimal, more low to the ground shoe, you can have that. But if you feel like, for any number of reasons, you like more cushion, you like, you know, the bouncy feel, that there's that too. So I think we're to have all the options going forward forevermore. And I'm glad for that too, because if you think about where Hoka started really at the zeitgeist of minimalism. And, you know, they brought out Hokas and people laughed and like, what? And yet it didn't take long. People realized, hey, we like cushion too. So it's an interesting time for sure. But also, I think that, you know, brands are finding ways to make a lot of things work.
And, you know, in your book, Kixology, Brian, you write about there's a competitive advantage to some of these shoes, like the Carbon X with the carbon plate providing a spring-type propulsion as you land and push off. It makes for an interesting discussion. You know, where is the line? Where do we draw the line between that's an unfair advantage, you're cheating, you're going too far with this product, you're just springing along versus, you know, human powered. It's almost
rockets in your shoes.
Yeah. I mean, where do we draw the line, or do we need to draw it at all? Do we just say, hey, if you can build it, you can run in it and forget about it?
I think like a nitrous oxide, like an assisted jet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's wrong?
I mean, that'd be great. You know? Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. I think two things. One, I think we've clearly are at a point where we've discovered ways, and by we, I mean the industry, discovered ways to make a better running shoe. I think this whole notion of soft foam and carbon fiber plates works, obviously. Most brands are doing it. Not all of them have carbon fiber in it, but certainly just the notion of soft foam, and then this, I would call most of the shoes more of a lever than a spring. I'll get to that in a second, but that really sets you up for this really firm kind of rolling through. It really kind of assists the rolling through of the foot and takes less energy, flexes the toes. I mean, there's a lot of things that have changed with that kind of design. Obviously, Nike was the first. Hoka's out there now. Saucony's got one coming out. ASICS has been working on a lot of shoes that have kind of a rigid plate. Some have carbon fiber, some don't. But I think we're at a time now where there's been an evolution of how to design a better shoe. Hopefully that can trickle down to the masses, because that, you know, the person that runs, you know, in a $100 shoe for the first time, you know, should have some of the same benefits. But I think we're at a different place. Where does it become a disadvantage? I think that if you look at the Kipchoge event in Austria last month, he actually ran in a shoe which I believe should be considered a spring, the Nike Alpha Fly, which has three layers of carbon fiber with a whole bunch of different stuff in it. I think they even stuck some of those, like those Halloween peeps in there, those little marshmallow things.
That's what it is.
And we know those peeps aren't made of anything real. It's all synthetic.
Anyway, I always wondered where they went, because no one eats them.
Right, but they're always around, right? Anyway, so I think that those things might be propelling things off. But you know, like I said in a Runner's World article recently, I said, look, I mean, you know, it's going to help you, but you've got to be fast. You've got to be fit. You've got to do the work. Running is, there's no silver bullet. You got to do the work, you know, you got to keep working hard and everything. So I think that at some point, yeah, there's got to be a line drawn to understand what is a competitive advantage for one brand over another. But at the same time, I also appreciate and like the progress quite a bit where we're assisting runners, and so many other sports have had new products come into play that have advance the game. I mean, carbon fiber golf club shafts and graphite hockey sticks, for example, oversized tennis rackets. You know, it's all happened, but it's got to be within reason. I think the biggest problem I have is if that Kipchoge shoe isn't available to everybody, if it's only a private model, then you have problems in a competitive race, an IAAF race, an Olympic trials race. Then you've got problems. And for that matter, the Western States, I wouldn't want to see somebody showing up with a super shoe that no one has and, you know, taking, you know, minutes off a record, you know?
Well, they have regulations like NASCAR. You can only have this size, you know, carburation. I don't know, they're probably fuel injected now, going back to the 1940s or something. But there are certain rules and standards, aluminum bat versus wooden bat. So is that what we do with this racing? We draw the line in the sand somewhere for these appliances?
Probably. I mean, I think you're right. You mentioned NASCAR, certainly Formula One. I mean, I think certainly there are good examples. I mean, like, you can only curve a hockey stick so much in the NHL. You know, if you curve a hockey stick too much, you're going to get more lift out of it. And so there's ways to certainly create a standard and also regulate those. I think, you know, the challenge, especially at trail running, I mean, like, you know, no one knows what you're putting on and no one knows what's happening. I mean, aid station to aid station, you could be changing stuff. I mean, like, who knows? I mean, so you'd hate to think that there's quote unquote mechanical doping. But certainly people are always trying to get an advantage of something. And that's, you know, that's the nature of competitiveness too, whether ethical or not. I'm not saying these are unethical. I think that certainly everyone, every brand, every athlete is trying to maximize the performance. But at some point, you have to ask, what is a shoe? And And is it cheating? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, it's, at some point, we'll probably see some regulations.
You know, you said everybody should have a fair opportunity. What if the shoe costs $1,000? That eliminates some people just financially out of the gate to be able to show up to the start line with a fair opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like right now, I mean, the Nike Next Percent costs $250, and there's a handful of unsponsored elite athletes that are 210 marathoners that dipped into their own pocket and bought that themselves. I'm not sure that $250 isn't already cost prohibitive. I mean, like, you can't. What if next year all the high school kids' shoes are $250? You can't expect parents to be spending that. So I agree. I mean, like, there's so many dimensions of this that change the game and change what we're talking about. And I don't think it's going to stop, unfortunately. I think that certainly innovation is fueling things, and that's good. But at some point, yeah, if we want a fair playing field, which I think we all do, a race is still a race between human beings. And there's probably going to have to be some, collective change in thinking.
I don't expect you to memorize this number, but and unfair, I just listened to your book, and it's available. At least I got it from Audible, Kixology, on that. And I love to listen as I run or drive or do something. In the 1980s, so $28 for a pair of shoes?
Yeah, I think we quickly forget maybe how much running shoes have escalated in price. I remember it wasn't that long ago, but maybe it was like 20 years ago when we first went over the $100 barrier, and people are like, what? But I look back at some of those shoes that I loved as a kid, the Adidas Oregon. I think we were talking, it was like, in maybe 1982 was, or 81 was like, $38 or whatever else. And that's, I guess you gotta measure that against the economy at the time and what the value of the dollar was at the time. I think when the Air Jordan basketball shoe came out, it was $65, and that was crazy expensive, right? Mm-hmm. That was 1984, 85. But two things happened. One, I mean, obviously running shoes became more of a commodity with more marketing and more hype to it. Certainly, materials change. You could argue that manufacturing costs change, fuel costs, everything to get a pair of shoes from a factory somewhere in East Asia to a retailer here has gotten more expensive. You can debate that in a lot of different ways, and I'm not by any means an economics professor, but certainly, shoes we think are affordable at $100, but remember, $100 is a lot of money. So $250 is crazy amount of money, right? And certainly we could spend money on a lot of worse things and never say a word about it, but running shoes certainly have gone up considerably.
I mentioned the PF Flyer earlier. Do you remember the Nike Cortez, that white shoe? Oh, that was a great shoe. Yeah. I'm convinced I could run much faster with that shoe.
Yeah, I think the best thing about that shoe was that Farrah Fawcett wore the women's version on Charlie's Angels once, and it went gangbusters. I think it, from the reporting I did, the people I talked to, that shoe, there was no instant gratification of the internet back then. But when she wore that on Charlie's Angels, I think within a couple of days, every retailer in the country sold out of those because it was such that big of a deal, right? And that shows what the power of television, had back then, which is, again, it would be simple as somebody going to their phone and buying it off the phone right now. But that's an interesting story because that shoe obviously was a cool thing, and it was one of the original designs of what Bowerman worked on. I actually have a pair of replicas that Nike remade about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and I refuse to wear them outside because, if you remember, they're all white with a red swoosh, and they have that little blue sliver of foam. That's how I remembered them as a kid, and I want to keep them that pristine. So if I wear them outside once, that changes the game.
I don't ever remember looking at Farrah's feet, but I do remember her red swimsuit. I think I had that on my wall.
Well, we have different interests at different times in our lives.
Hey, I want to talk about another subject that is related to running shoes that you get into that I thought was just fascinating. That is the running store, the brick and mortar running specialty store. And it's crazy to me that in a day and age and we're getting close to the gift giving season, I see an Amazon package on my doorstep every day. And it's so easy to go out and just buy stuff online. Why is the running store still a going concern? And is it going to stay there?
Or relevant? Why is it still relevant?
That's a really good question. And I love running stores. I've never worked in one, but I've been to a gazillion of them. And I just love the vibe in there as a runner, as a person, and not even so much as a shopper, but just going and feel the vibe. I mean, as a kid, the first running stores I remember being in had like posters of Bill Rogers and like just cool stuff, inspirational stuff. And like, as a kid wanting to run, you know, getting more involved in it, I was just like in awe. Right. And so I think that speaks to the culture of running. And yet we've lost a lot of that in the last 10 years, especially as a lot of these stores have changed hands or become modernized and have better, you know, retailing practices and merchandising practices. But I do think there is a vibe in most good specialty running stores that really speaks to, kind of this collective feeling and this community of running that we all love. And whether it's a trail running store or just a, you know, suburban road running store, I think that's present. That's why it's viable and important. But I know that it's really hard for retailers right now because of online sales. It's so easy to buy from your phone or your laptop at any hour of the day. And you don't have to wait for what you want. I mean, there's that instantaneous kind of feeling of, I need new shoes, and that's how I get them. But I do think that going into a running store is more about inspiration and motivation. Again, that connection with the community. I mean, I find that running store group runs are one of the best things I've ever done, because you meet people, you see people, you run with people, you might have a beer afterwards, whatever, but it's a cool feeling of kind of connecting to the core of why we all do this, you know? And so I could name a dozen running shops that have gone out of business in the last bunch of years, and that's sad. And there's new ones too, but I do think that running stores are important, maybe in the same way, and sadly, how record stores have gone out of business, you know? As a kid, I used to go to record stores, and that's where you would find the music you wanted, but also there was local experts that could really help you. Okay, the song, you know, is a new Rush album out or whatever it is. And those people were kind of authorities and experts and tied to the culture of the music industry, right? Just the way retailers are too. So I think there's a parallel there. And sadly, there aren't many record stores anymore because Amazon can sell anything that's, you know, the size of a loaf of bread or smaller better than anyone, you know, and that's kind of a big scare for a lot of running stores for sure.
Tell us a little bit about the story, and I should have made a note on this about the running store. I think it's in Minnesota or somewhere out there.
Naperville running store.
That's it. Yeah. Tell us about that story and what is the secret sauce that makes that store work?
Yeah, it's interesting. Chris Hartner is a good guy and a great retailer. And, you know, he worked in the industry for a handful of different running brands. He had, as a kid and as a teenager, worked in a bunch of running stores and felt that vibe and that connection to the culture of running. And I think he took all those things, including what was he learned in the industry for the bigger brands when he was in development and engineering and everything else. And he kind of sensed, okay, running was at a point in about 2000, 2001, where it was really growing again. And if you recall back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, it was a pretty tight-knit, you know, you were runners if you went to a running store. And the big thing that was changing in the early 2000s was that people were coming to the store saying, oh, I'm not really a runner, but I need shoes, right? Because there was that disconnect of the core runners and everyone else. And now the core runners are much smaller than the bigger pie of runners, and that's changed. But to the point of Naperville Running Company, Chris Hartner really found a location. Naperville, Illinois is like the consummate American suburb, growing in all dimensions, and had a lot of people had recreational fitness, a lot of kids going to high school running cross country. There's a lot of great high school programs there, a great D3 school, North Central College was there, and it really became one of the epicenters for what the new growth, this next boom of running was. And so Chris is a smart guy and a good guy, but what I think he really realized is that treat your customers with respect, you know, and cater to their needs one-on-one. And honestly, it's not too much more than that. Certainly there's good business practices behind the scenes. I know he treats his employees really well. He trusts his employees a lot. But really, that person coming in the door just saying, I'm not a runner, but I need shoes, was a customer for life. If you could take care of them, have them try on shoes, explain what you're doing, and really go out of your way to serve that person, and help them share in the passion of running. And I think that's what Naperville Running Company has done so, so well. And certainly their business reflects it. They've added a couple stores in adjacent towns, and you know, that would be the model. And there's a lot of great retailers out there, don't get me wrong, but that would be the model for really how to build a retail base and a customer base, because they knock it out of the park.
You know, there's stability shoes. There's all kinds of different categories. How do we make sure that as we go in, we're getting good advice from some of these retailers or some of these people that are coaching us through this shoe purchase? Should we put complete faith in them, or are there other avenues that you think are better for us?
That's a really good question. I think that and there's still a whole lot of debate on that. I mean, I think the whole idea of pronation has been a little bit of a four-letter word in our world, but certainly all runners, most runners pronate, some of them supinate, but most runners pronate to some degree. The only challenge with pronation is that if your foot rolls in to a very strong degree, it's going to have changes in how your knee aligns and your lower legs align. So certainly we all know the many common overuse injuries that happen from that. So it's a real situation. How you get a shoe that helps you, there's a lot of debate on that. I think that some of my best advice always comes from Mark Plachis, who is a Boulder retailer, and he was the 1993 world champion in the marathon. But more so than that, he's a physical therapist, and he's what I would call a real shoe whisperer. A foot whisperer. And so he has always put people on a treadmill to watch their gait. I know that there's controversy around that, saying that you can't see much unless it's a super high speed camera. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I do know that, like, again, that taking the time to work with each individual runner and understanding their gait, understanding kind of if they do have injuries, where things hurt, why things hurt, is important. I think that there is the ability to find a better shoe for a person than a worse shoe. I think that that might include semi-custom insoles or something like that. And so I think there's a lot of things you need to take into consideration. But to your point too, the other element, the other magic element that's very real, is how it fits and how comfortable it is for you. Again, that brain to foot proprioceptive feeling is a big deal. There's been studies that show that, and you know, only in the last maybe 15 years have we really considered that, but I really think that's a big deal. Certainly as a brand new runner, you might not know that, but as a runner who's run for 3 to 5 to 10 to 25 years, you can sense kind of how your foot hits the ground and how your body moves in relation to that. And so if you look at something like, you know, maximal cushioning or minimal cushioning or heel drop of 12 versus a heel drop of 4 or 0, certainly your body is moving in different dimensions in different ways. And I think that comfort, that understanding of your foot to the brain is a super big part of that. And so should you trust somebody 100%? You should definitely get guidance. I think those great shoe fitters in our sport are valuable, but I think your input is a big, big part of that too.
Boy, I really like that, Brian. And I hadn't heard someone communicate like you have. We talk about learning to listen for thirst when you're on the trail, or listen when you need to speed up, slow down, or just listening to clues from our body. We need to trust our body on shoe fit too. What does it feel like? What's the first thing that your foot says to your brain? Good, bad, you like it, you don't like it? You should weigh that very heavy in your decision process, because you're the one that's ultimately in this shoe, and you're getting feedback that observer is not.
Although I'm gonna disagree with you there.
Yeah, you can.
Because
let's do it after the podcast.
I think, and this is the question I'd like to ask Brian, since you didn't ask one.
I was about to. Go ahead.
And that's this. I think, at least I have this conspiracy theory, that there's some shoe manufacturers that make their shoes feel like pillows, so that when you go into the running store, it looks like the fastest shoe. It looks so cool. And you put your foot in it and it feels like a cloud or a pillow, and you walk around it in the store. And if they let you out the door, maybe you run down to the end of the block and back, and you're thinking, this thing is the shoe. And it's erroneous that that it may not be the right shoe, because you're going to go out and you're going to do some pretty long miles in this pillow that may only last 5 miles.
Brian, I'm going to interrupt you, okay? Because I know you were supposed to answer this, but since he took issue with me, I'm going to answer this. And Mr. War, you need at that point for your brain to say, hey, you know what? This isn't good for me. I know, I've experienced this in the past.
I don't like pillows.
Pillows are not good for long runs. So you pass on it. Okay, Brian, go ahead.
Okay. Technically, there are no questions here, but I'll answer them myself.
make up your own question, Brian, and answer it.
And we'll guess what the question is. Go ahead.
So part one, I think, well, maybe it was part two, but part two was, shoe brands have been guilty as charged of fabricating this thing called step-in feel, right? Uh-huh. You go to a running store and step in, like, oh, it feels good. What feels good about it? Why does it feel that way? What kind of foam is it? Certainly brands have used extra cushy insoles, all kinds of tricks to make something feel better. Doesn't mean it's going to run better. And I think, back to the first part of that, I think, it's like understanding what your body feels is super important, especially on the trails, especially as a trail runner. I'm a little bit spoiled for two reasons. One, because I live in Boulder, and two, because I have a lot of trail shoes. But I do tell people that when I go out for a trail run and I know where I'm going, I will choose a shoe that is specifically or close to specifically geared toward that as possible, right? And we don't have the joy of doing that. For the trail runners that have one pair of shoes in their quiver, okay, fine. The point is, there's many different types of terrain. The terrain varies so much. We go out for short runs or long runs, and so all those things have different kind of criteria, or we have different needs tied to those. And so, I think certainly as trail runners, more so than ever, or more than anyone, to your point, we have to listen to our body and understand that. As for getting shoe fitted in a store, you got to watch out for things that might not make sense. How it feels when you run, especially for a trail shoe, on the concrete or the carpet in the running store doesn't have anything to do with how it's going to feel on a trail. So I think that, certainly you've got to be savvy to understand the type of terrain you're going to be on, whether you need a rock plate or not, whether you need more flex, if you're going to be running on really gnarly, rugged, jagged rocks, more often than not. I mean, those are the kind of things as a trail runner we really have to understand.
And there's so many variables from one runner to the next when it comes to designing a shoe.
Sorry.
When it comes to designing a shoe, you have to think about the weight of the person, the body weight. Are they heel striking, forefoot striking? Do they overstride? What are the variables? What is their pace that they're running? And all of these things are left out of the equation when you're, considering a shoe, because we're all a little bit different.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that right now we're dealing with, a lot of the things are coming to the forefront right now. And one of the things I alluded to in my book, I think Jay DeSherry, Portland, or a Bend, Oregon physical therapist, trail runner, and really another shoe whisperer in this world, said something like, a shoe brand could make a shoe or a line of shoes much more sensible than they're doing right now, right? You could create, a matrix of shoes that are based on body weight, body mass, size, shape, speed, those things like that, and just start from a really basic level, and you could have shoes tuned relative to those various sizes. You have a small, medium, and large man or woman profile. Because right now, if somebody buys a Brooks Ghost or a Salomon Speed Cross, it's not tuned to a 200-pound man or a 104-pound woman, right? It's relatively smaller, but it's not tuned to that. And what I mean by that is, you could get much more specific in finding that shoe that, this guy is 180 pounds and he runs 7-minute miles. This woman is 112 pounds and she runs 8-minute miles. There's ways to create a more kind of specifically targeted kind of footwear product for those sizes and shapes. And to that point, there is a brand, there's a guy I met with last week who's working on that kind of concept. I think their shoes are going to launch in 2020. I can't say anything about it now, but that's definitely happening. So, and they have some interesting science too. They're looking into, kind of some of the things about size I just mentioned and different kind of ground force reactions, things like that, that really will have an impact if they can launch this brand based on that.
Yeah, it's like, this shoe was designed and built for Killian. And I go, well, great, but unfortunately, I'm 50 pounds heavier and I'm twice as slow. So is that the right shoe for me? So are these shoes built when you're getting a shoe off the shelf? Are they built and designed for our elite athletes and their size and pace? And the rest of us need to go to the Brooks Beast?
that's a very interesting thing. I mean, one of the big differences between you know, elite athletes in us is elite athletes, you know, do a crazy amount of extra things. You know, I've had the great experience to be around Meb Keflezighi for a long time and plenty of ultra trail runners we all know. And those, you know, those athletes are doing so many more athletic things in running than a lot of us are. I'll speak for myself, but just, you know, jogging around the trails or whatever. But they're a lot more dynamically strong and fit and limber and all these things. And so to answer your question, I mean, there are a lot of shoes that are built for, slower jogger or runner types than say like the Nike 4%. I mean, so it comes down to how it fits your running style, when you're running gait, your shoe size, your shoe shape, or your foot size, your foot shape. So there's so many variables that go into it, but certainly understanding a shoe that's right for you, wherever you are in this time and space continuum of how fast or fit you are or anything like that is important. And so there's shoes that we all could do better to be in, and there's shoes that we should avoid because they just aren't meant for us, you know? So it's like, that's the big puzzle. If there's 120 shoes on the wall, which four or five are good for me?
I'm going to go back to the PF Flyer because I was faster back then when I was running. You cover in the book, and you've had the opportunity to go to some of these shoe factories and see them put together, you know, in I don't know if it was in China or where you were, where they're building like 3,000 pair of shoes per day.
Tell us a little bit
about that.
That was really fascinating because, I've heard a lot of stories for years, and we all hear stories. And there was a lot of, what I would call, bad news on the labor front for a lot of brands and everything else. And maybe right, maybe wrong. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But I do know that having been in two factories in China and then also seeing the production of what New Balance does in New England, they have five factories there. They're both very similar, believe it or not. I think the cost of labor is different. Obviously, New England are paying different wages than what's being paid in China. But I think that the most important takeaway I got from both of those situations is that shoes are very much a handmade, one-by-one kind of situation. We talk about automation or a factory. We think Henry Ford in this automobile line, right? And there's some of that happening, but mostly not. I mean, like there's no robotic arms that are picking up the shoe and putting them on. It's human beings that are touching these things. And there might be 75 to 150 tasks to build one shoe with all the materials. All the pieces are laid out and everyone has their own kind of zone and a certain job to do for that moment. But to me, it was really moving. And every time I put on a pair of shoes now, I think, wow, human beings really put their craft and their energy and their effort into this. And they're making a living doing this. And it's really impressive to see. And two things. I mean, I think that the factories I was in China seemed to have mostly good practices. I'm not a judge of that. I was not there as a journalist, so no one was trying to hide anything from me. I was there kind of invited by a friend. But the good news about that is, I saw people, taking breaks for lunch and getting stretching breaks, and people were, seemed to be amicably working. Again, they didn't know who I was relative to what I was doing with the book. But, and then same thing in New England, New Balance has taken pride in their domestic workforce, because they want to build a good percentage of shoes here. And they have a lot of families and generations of people who work in those factories. But again, there's a lot of well-being, for the worker involved. And that being said, again, just when you put on a pair of shoes, you know that 70 to 80 people touched and worked on that shoe is really amazing.
I wonder if that's where part of this special energy or feeling comes from, because they are crafted by people, by their hands. I wonder if that's carried into the shoe in some way. I know that's a little out there, a little esoteric, but I've got to think that there's that relationship between humans.
If it helps you, absolutely.
It helps me, especially at mile 50.
I think so. I think it comes down to, it's like, as much as we think there's mass production and everything in this world, including food, for better or for worse, I do think that, like, even watching somebody die cut all the pieces, there's a lot of die cut pieces, there's a lot of, molded pieces and stuff like that, but somebody is doing all those things. It's you know, it's fascinating to watch. And you know, there's a lot of dangerous elements too, but like somebody's taking a stencil and putting these dies down so they can cut these piece of foam or rubber or whatever else. Again, it's really cool and it's really empowering. And you know, I guess you could say that too about your automobile, but that seems a little more distant. This is again, when you put it on something that puts that fits your foot specifically and you take out to run in this very personal kind of experience you have on a daily basis, knowing that all these people worked on what you're running in, to me is a big deal. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at it for sure. And I'm glad that from what I can tell, the industry is better than it was in terms of labor, but it's definitely fascinating. And again, there's no full on automation of factories just cranking out shoes. It's people touching them.
Hey, Brian, how long should I run in my shoes? How many miles can I run before I should think about replacing them?
Like tonight after the show or just in general?
At least back to the trailhead, Scott.
4 miles. 4 miles, then you turn around.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, materials have changed over the years. I mean, I remember when I first started running, I think they said
300?
Yeah, 300 miles. Are they lasting longer?
Yes, I think they're definitely lasting longer. A couple things. I mean, the old idea of having to break in a shoe is totally lost. You don't have to break in any shoe. There's not any breaking in process that happens anymore. But I think that materials are definitely lasting longer, and the shoes are lasting longer. They're built better. I remember tons of shoes that delaminated or fell apart or just came out, and in a short period of time, after maybe 100 or 150 miles. And so I think now that it's hard to really gauge on a mileage number, but I think if it was 300 to 400, it's definitely 400 to 500 or more. I think depending on how you run in them, I think is key. I mean, obviously people are running a lot more crazy ultras. I mean, like, you know, I probably have a bunch of Hoka Challengers and Speed Goats that I've probably run 600 miles in, you know, and but there are key things to look for. I think certainly when you start to feel aches and pains that either aren't typical or that don't go away, that's a sign that, like, okay, the footwear is maybe broken down and your body is changing its gait a little bit, things like that. Certainly obvious signs of wear. Obviously there's a lot of shoes that have more exposed foam. That can wear out pretty quickly. So as much as the shoes are lasting longer because of the materials and the manufacturing are much, much better. I think certainly you still got to be aware and kind of listen to your body again and really understand kind of maybe how you're running different once the shoe breaks down.
And there's body weight has got to play a part into it. If you're 120 versus 220, you're going to fatigue that foam a bit quicker as a 220 guy.
Absolutely. And that also take care of your shoes too. I mean, don't leave them in the hot sun. Don't leave them in the trunk of your car. Certainly when a foam is cold, it's going to run different than when it's hot or warm, things like that. I think that, you know, if you clean your shoes, it's not about aesthetics. It's more about how the shoes wear. I mean, if you run through muddy water, all that, you know, filth and muck stays in the shoe when your shoe dries out. And so that causes the shoe to flex differently. And so as much as we all love muddy shoes, it helps to wash them and keep them clean for performance reasons, really.
Do we ever throw our shoes in a washing machine?
I do at times, but certainly never the dryer, obviously, or the microwave for that matter.
Toaster ovens or waffle makers, I've heard, are good for shoes.
Yeah, all those things. But I think there's a lot of ways to clean your shoes and a good reason to do it. I mean, simply putting it in like a sink and a scrub brush works. I think that typically I've always stuffed them with newspaper and left them, you know, in a warmish but not super hot place. And again, more so than not, almost every material is synthetic now. When there was more, when there was pieces of leather or things that would shrink, that was a different story. But I still would never put them in the dryer. I think that certainly the higher heat would impact the materials in different ways. So yeah, I think cleaning your shoes is a good thing. Taking care of them, treating them like with respect. You know, I always tell people, don't mow the lawn in your running shoes. Don't wear your running shoes that you run in as your everyday shoes, because you walk in a different gait, you break them down in different ways. And if you want to run as a trail runner, keep them for trail running. You know, if you want to run, for marathon stuff or for speed workouts, don't walk around in them. Don't wear them to work. Don't mow the lawn, and don't do any gardening in them.
I think that was one of the first rules I learned from my mentors when I started running. Is they said, you need to go get a good pair of running shoes from a brick and mortar, somebody that you can trust. And then you put them aside and they are running shoes until you retire them. And then they can come become lawn mowing shoes. That was one of the rules that they taught me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, again, you know, treat your running shoes with care and respect as you would with a tennis racket or with anything else that you really appreciate. You do, you know, I guess if you're a bowler, you would treat your bowling ball with respect. If you're whatever, you know, tennis racket, golf club, I mean, like, treat it with that much respect and don't leave it lying around so the dog can pick it up. Don't leave it tied and pull it off your foot and try and come back and jam your foot in it. Those things actually are pretty detrimental to a lot of things about the shoe. So, again, treat it with respect, just as you would your very best race day shoes. You know, your average daily trainer should do the same thing.
Mm. One of the chapters that I found fascinating, and I can't believe that we're all the way to the end of the podcast, I'm just now asking this question, but is the whole idea that with all the evolutions of shoes and getting NASA engineers to develop an air pocket for the Nike Air Max and all of these innovations that we've had, that there has been no study, or at least that's what I interpreted from your book, that there's no studies out there that show that running shoes either help prevent injuries or cause injuries, that the rate of injuries has not decreased or increased over the evolution of these shoes.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, I do think that science is catching up to running and running shoe development, which is a good thing. I think you're seeing more kind of data informed design, which is great. I think in the past there was, you know, from the time people started in the mid 70s talking about pronation, there was a lot of kind of guesstimation of understanding of, okay, the foot goes in, so we need to put more firmer foam here. It's much smarter than that now, which is good, and much, much above my pay grade too. I do think it's fascinating that running injuries haven't been studied that much as they relate to shoes. I think, you know, a lot of experts will say that running shoes don't cause injuries. Certainly running gait, repetitive running gait, abnormalities cause injuries. Can a shoe cause you to run poorly or not the way your gait is naturally intended? Yeah, for sure. So I guess there is a causal relationship. Yeah, okay, if you're running in a bad shoe or a shoe not meant for you, could it lead to an overuse injury? Perhaps it could, but it's your gait that's causing that more than anything else. I could run in a pair of hiking boots on a track at 100 meters and potentially get hurt, or run in a pair of snow boots, you know? So it's not necessarily the product, it's really how you're running that causes the injury. And certainly there's ways to modify the shoe, but certainly, again, that's about your gait. But to your point, it is interesting, and maybe troubling too, that running shoes and injuries connection has not been studied. I think there's not a lot of brands that would love to see that. I think that maybe for fear of their own shoes being singled out. You know, Nike is about to release a shoe that they think will greatly reduce injuries. And that's, I think it's in the very last chapter of my book. I think it's called the Nike React Infinity, I think, comes out in early January. And, you know, whatever their belief in how it was developed and materials, apparently it was vetted out and verified by, I believe, University of British Columbia. So it'll be interesting to see when some of that science comes out. Again, there's always a skeptical side of me that says, okay, this is a brand that is funding its own research, and, you know, how is that going to come out in the wash? So I don't know. I think it, you know, running injuries are real, and 50%, 60% of people get injured every year. But my take is more that, you know, our runners doing all they can to be as fit and as strong to endure the miles of running. And I think that's the bigger thing you can fix right now is your own body, you know, more than shoes.
Hey, as we get wrapped up here, I have a final question for you. As a shoe reviewer, 1,500 different shoes, how do you stay neutral, or how do you not lean too far to being very positive or too negative, or how do you handle that as a shoe reviewer? Can we trust our reviewers? Give us the inside story.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think one, I've tried to stay brand agnostic my entire life. I mean, like, and I don't know how I've done that, as much as I've always liked a few models and disliked a few models from every brand, and then maybe that kind of equals things out. So I'm not a homer for any brand at all. I think that there's great, innovative, cool, performance-oriented shoes that I've loved, and then there's a bunch of just like, oh, this is horrible. It's heavy. It's it's awkward. So I've always tried to do that. I've always tried to keep that in mind. I think that I did come up through traditional journalism and understanding that, you know, and there's everything from there's no cheering in the press box to like, look, you're trying to offer a service to people, to readers, you know, and trying to be true about things. And, but to that point, gosh, there's so many kinds of reviews out there and there's so many different things. You know, some quote unquote reviews I think are totally worthless and some are actually very good. And so I think when you go to read about a shoe, the most important thing is that you're kind of gaining information or insights more than you are kind of making your decision. I think your decision again is always going to be between yourself, your brain, your foot, and many different models that you're trying on. I think that reviews may be different than like a record review or maybe more like a record review, but like less so like a car review. I mean, like it comes down to what you need, what you want, and kind of how to make that happen. And certainly you have to understand that reviewers are, even if they have a group of testers behind them, are still only a limited slice of how those shoes fit those people's feet, you know? And so, you know, I think every media brand or every blogger tries to do their own thing. And there's some funny stuff out there, some good stuff. There's, you know, it's really evolved and it's kind of fun to see, but, yeah, you really got to trust yourself and just use those bits as like, you know, helpful information to get you on your path to finding your shoe.
You're an expert shoe reviewer. What about the Amazon 1 to 5 star reviews? Do you ever read those and use them to make your decision, Brian?
No, actually I don't. And, you know, those are such a science behind that. There's so many bots out there clicking and making a mess of everything we do and all this digital, you know, so-called digital analytics and everything else. It certainly got out of hand. I mean, like, and it's almost amusing at some point. I mean, certainly a Nike Pegasus might get, you know, 4.6 stars. And the question I would ask you is, what does that mean to you? You know, and like, I mean, I think the Speed Goat 3, you know, is a shoe that fits and works for some people and for others it does not, you know. I mean, some people like, you know, the Nike, Wild Horse. You know, so everyone has their favorite shoe, but it's based on hopefully how it fits them. And that's, I guess that's the secret sauce. I mean, like, again, we all run differently. We all feel the ground differently if we're running fast or slow. And some of us run faster workouts and some of us just like to do long, you know, 20 mile trail runs. And again, it's how you interact. It's what running is to you. It's how you interact with the ground. And like, you know, it's more art than it is science, I think.
Yeah, I think the even the more reason we should respect our brick and mortar and pay the premium price, because there are too many shoes and out there, too many opinions that may not be relevant to what we're looking for. We need to be able to put our hands on them, twist them, torque them, smell them, and put our thumb in the heel to see if they work for us.
I mean, if you're buying melons or avocados, especially your avocados,
yeah,
I think we should fingerprint them all over the place.
Hey, Brian, at the time of your life right now and the trail, your favorite trail around Boulder and where you are in your life, what right now is your favorite shoe to go run that favorite trail?
Wow, that's put me on the spot, right? I mean, yeah, like, yeah. I got to think what's in my garage right now. I've been running a lot in the Saucony Peregrine 10 recently. I like the changes of that. I think it's a very runnable shoe. It's a very good shoe. I've run, like I said, I mentioned the Speed Goat before. I've run a lot of miles in Speed Goats. I didn't do any ultras this year. Last year, I wore Speed Goats and Challengers quite a bit. I like for Boulder because we have a lot of dry surfaces, a lot of hard rock surfaces. There's a lot of good Sportiva shoes that I wear that have good sticky rubber. I think that's important. I don't run a lot of gravel roads. More just the trails here are dry or sandy or hard rock, so that makes sense for that. I have run in the Terra quite a bit, and if you're asking me to get to one, I'll
go. I was going to say, so far you've mentioned four.
Okay. I mean, one of my all time favorite trail running shoes of all time was the Nike Air Tupu, which was like 2002, maybe only lasted a year or two. It was light and fast and love of the ground. And I just loved it, you know, and, but that's the point. I mean, shoes are always changing. Right. And so what is current right now, could be, or should be, or will be different, next season or the season after. So, I'm not going to narrow it down to one, but
We could see that.
And I agree with you. I think that it's hard to narrow it down. And I will say one of my big pet peeves is when you finally find that model of that shoe that you love, and it may be the K
Cascadia 3, let's say. And the next year, the Cascadia 3 is replaced with a Cascadia 4, and it's not the same shoe.
Yeah, not even close.
Please. That's the only, if I think about it, that's the only reason why I would ever go online and shop, is if I can't go to the brick and mortar and get the shoe that I want because it's out of production, then I could go and buy it.
And I think I'm changing faster than the shoe, actually. So I think it's more me than the shoe itself.
But both are very good points. Both are very good points. Oh, one more shoe I like a lot lately is the New Balance Hero, or aside from great colors, it's a really good shoe that fits great for me and adheres to the trail quite well.
In New Balance MT-101 or 100, do you remember that shoe?
Yeah.
That was a good shoe.
Yeah, orange and gray, maybe 2007-ish, I think.
I was faster back then.
Yeah, well, we were all faster, lighter, and smarter too, right?
Yeah.
That was one of the shoes that launched certainly the minimalist craze, certainly along with, going back further, the Nike Free line, certainly Five Fingers, Newton came out around the same time. I think the beauty of all that, the minimalism, is that it taught people what they like or don't like, and it also taught people that form is important, how you run is important, and then also it really kind of put a charge in manufacturing to make lighter shoes. If you recall, in the early 2000s, so many shoes, including trail shoes, were so overbuilt, so heavy, and it forced this minimalism, forced people to get lighter materials. Certainly industries came out with lighter materials that weren't around before, but I think all that kind of really helped, and I think that we're still benefiting from that brief boom of craziness that was tied to minimalism.
Well, this is a great book, Kixology, The Hype, Science, Culture, and Cool of Running Shoes by Brian Metzler. We've enjoyed the conversation today.
Who doesn't like to talk about shoes?
We all do. And Brian, thanks so much for joining us to kick this around today.
Hey guys, I really appreciate it. I think to this point, I mean, the conversations about this stuff is so fascinating and so fun. Yeah. I think your questions were spot on. I think that, coming from, all different backgrounds of running, I think we all appreciate that there are different things out there, but I think this is the essence of what, is tied to all of us, the shoes, and that's tied to the culture and the satisfaction and the joy and all this stuff. Right. And that's why we're still running. Even if, like you said, our bodies have changed or our life has changed, we still run and we still, lace up shoes every day.
I want to go shoe shopping now.
And if you want this continuation, this conversation to continue, all you have to do is order the book either through Audible or
Amazon. You can. That's another reason why you can order it on Amazon, is you can get this book on Amazon.
You could even go to a brick and mortar bookstore, perhaps.
They
could
find a few of those.
And you could find this book. So if you want to continue the conversation, that's where you go. Every page is a winner, and we really enjoyed reading it and talking about it. So thanks a lot, Brian.
Thanks, guys. I very much appreciate it.
Now go out and run.
Mass.